Welcome to Dark Mood Woods, a Twin Peaks podcast.
Clean shirt, new shoes. I don't know where I'm going to. Silk suit, black tie. I don't need a reason.
Thank you for joining us. This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And our guest this week is...
Abby Bender.
Woo! Thank you for joining us, Abby. I mean, we ask all our guests what they've thought of the return so far. And I'm going to ask you that, but I'm also... I want to get this at the front of the show. I want to ask you a bit about the article you just wrote about Twin Peaks The Return.
Oh, yes. Well, so I'll start with that. And I was hoping that, as much as I loved this episode, I thought it was really great. But I was hoping that Diane would be on, because my article was a piece for Racked, which is a fashion website. And I wrote about Diane's fashion and her bringing style, if you will, back to Twin Peaks. Because they're such a strong... I mean, I write a lot about fashion and film. And in the... original Twin Peaks, there were so many really strong looks. There was, you know, like if you just mention Twin Peaks season one, season two to people, they'll picture instantly saddle shoes, sweaters, all that jazz. But this season hasn't really had that. And I just thought it was really interesting to see Diane with her wig, with her trousers. And yeah, so I just wrote a little exploration of her outfits and the fleeting glimpses we've seen of her, and talked about the role that her fashion has played on the show. I also introduced us maybe, I mean, I don't know how much weight this has, but I also introduced a theory that her multicolored manicure could symbolize the multiplicity of identity, because, like, hey, it's Twin Peaks, you know? So definitely everyone should read it. It's on Racked. It's also pinned on my Twitter page.
Well, that's the way to do it.
And then the other thing you asked was just my thoughts on the show so far. Well, I mean, I've been really liking it. I mean, as I'm sure everybody has been saying, I'm amazed at the level of freedom that Lynch has, just that he's really just seems to be doing whatever he wants. It's amazing to see. And it's definitely like the most auteurist television probably ever. I'm not going to lie, like there are moments where I've gotten kind of frustrated, just like some of the scenes that are very slow, or like the scenes with Audrey and her husband, or like the scenes where it's like some of the scenes at the roadhouse where there are people talking, just like I have no idea what the hell these people are talking about. But because I feel like I'm a fan of Lynch and I know enough about his work to know that it's like I just have this idea that it all makes sense somehow in his head, and he's like transmitting this weird vision to us, and it's really cool to just sort of be able to soak in that vision, if that makes sense.
Totally. Well, I mean, if I sort of, every week I've kind of maybe repeated this one theory I've had about sort of the rhythms of the show and how I think that it has certain high points than certain, I guess it has peaks and valleys, so to speak. Though at many times I enjoy the valleys just as much as the peaks, but I think I can say with these last two episodes, I really feel the show kicking into third act hyperdrive, so to speak. Would both of you agree?
Yeah, watching this episode, I got to thinking about the structure of the series, as I do in literally every episode, but particularly the fact that when this started, we were granted, I think, what you, Ethan, called a four-hour content bomb, which is to say the first four episodes of the series, and how we are now in the final four episodes of the series. And in a way, perhaps it's beginning to mirror itself a little bit, at least with regards to a major development with Dale Cooper. And I would also say kind of the infringing of Black Lodge figures and Black Lodge material upon the quote-unquote real world is becoming more and more pronounced. And I think it's been clear from the beginning, I mean, clear literally from the first scene of the series, that Cooper's journey and the Black Lodge's kind of outgrowth were going to mix and mingle in the show. But now it seems like we're seeing it a lot more, that it's coming to the forefront in what to me is a pretty exciting way. We had this week a scene that I think frustrated fans have in essence been waiting for about 3 months now. And what that will lead to, I'm actually not certain, because nothing is certain in this particular case. But yeah, no, we are seeing certain things ramp up. We're also seeing certain things wind down, it feels like. By all accounts, Caleb Landry Jones's character is gone. The sort of...
He won't miss him.
Really?
Oh, gosh. It's like, I guess, a good character for the show, but just, I want to slap him. He's so gross and so sleazy and horrible. But he's supposed to be that way.
No, definitely. And as I've said before, it's kind of this and the Safdie brothers is heaven knows what. It's director's understanding that Caleb Landry-Jones has a certain kind of screen presence, let's say.
And Get Out.
Oh, okay, I haven't seen Get Out.
Yeah, no, he's like the really gross, like douchey white brother.
Oh, okay. Well, here you go. That's the unified theory of Caleb Landry-Jones, which
I think
we saw evidence of this week.
Yeah, I think this week arguably was Caleb Landry-Jones at his most Caleb Landry-Jones.
Oh, fun. Yeah. Also, this is like not totally related, but something I've been noticing. Have you guys been talking at all about like the use of color in the show? Because that's something I found really interesting.
I mean, I think we've brought up about the show's kind of maybe the lighting more than the color, in terms of some of the daytime scenes having a bit of a high key look compared to the nighttime scenes. But
because I've been noticing there's just like a ton of this like kind of sickly fuchsia color just like everywhere, like on people's clothes and like lips, women's lipstick, and like the even like elements of like the furniture and like the design. And there was a very strong example of that in this episode with Caleb Landry-Jones and the girlfriend, I'm forgetting the actress's name, Alicia
Witt,
I think. Yeah. And they were both wearing shirts that were like that color, and they're like in the forest, and I was just like, oh my god, it's the Twin Peaks fuchsia again.
Very nice. Yeah,
I kind of want to make a chart of like every time that color appears. I feel like that'd be me going into like crazy fan mode, because it's like a distinctive shade.
I mean, if we want to talk about colors, I brought this up on a few episodes of the show, how I watched this on, well, at least the first episode I always watch on Crave TV, the Canadian streaming service. And I will say, I think the, what you could call the Black Lodge portion, or just the supernatural portion of this episode, is something that I think really suffered from watching it in a compressed state. I mean, I could still tell it was incredibly beautiful images and direction, but I mean, how generally, even I watched the episode again today after work, and I was like, I still turned off the lights in my room so I could kind of try to see better.
Those blacks can get a little bit muddy with streaming, which I feel bad about, because I'm like, oh man, this is like David Lynch's vision.
As I like to say, the thing I do like about watching it on Crave TV in not the best condition is that I feel like the people who are probably watching the original back on their tube television back in 1990.
Or like on their VCR, yeah.
Yeah. If we want to talk more about the pace of this episode, I feel like, again, as with many of the other episodes, it has very much, it starts with sustained sequences, thinking of the Norman Ed sequence, the Black Lodge sequence, then the Caleb Landry-Jones sequence, then I think transitions into a more elliptical structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, the opening, the scene with Norma and Ed, it was so good. Like, I loved how many emotional beats that Lynch was able to get into one scene. It was like its own little movie within the show, which I thought was really cool.
Mm. It also, I mean, it's funny too, watching it, because it is entirely possible that we will kind of never return to those characters, that'll kind of be the settling point of it. Because it feel, I mean, not only does it feel very climactic, but it's the kind of thing that maybe doesn't have a clear place in the general structure of the show, it, excepting the fact that it is there. The fact that it's there might be the most you could say.
Yeah, and but, it was really, an emotion, like it was very, very happy, probably like the happiest thing that's happened on Twin Peaks so far.
Just about. I mean, it's one of the, I was thinking to myself that it's one of the most joyous things Lynch has ever directed, perhaps. I mean, even just the way that the music is being layered over those landscape images, mm-hmm. and how the, it's almost as if in that moment, the entire project is willing to kind of break away from itself, or it's willing to break away from certain kind of narrative and visual patterns it's established to just kind of have this moment of freedom, as if almost as if the show is kind of soaring out of its troubles for a minute, going into the trees and going into the mountains and looking at the sky with that absolutely like breathtaking vision of the sky with a very kind of ethereal daytime clouds and the Otis Redding song just sort of giving it this uplift. It was just, loved it.
Also, did you guys, you probably saw this, but there was that interview with Lynch in the Times recently about his sound design.
Yes.
And there was this great, I mean, as is always the case with Lynch, he did not really reveal any secrets of the show, but he did talk, obviously, a bit about sound design, and he said at one point, and I thought this is a great quote, he was just like, I love the wind in the trees. And, like, I love how he uses that for, like, joyous things and ominous things, and it's just, like, it creates so much texture within the world of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just, like, such a Lynchy phrase. Like, the way he
Oh, no, no, yeah, you can definitely hear him saying that.
It's, like, ambiguous, but also, like, very clear, the way he's phrasing that.
Precisely, yeah. Yeah. Also, I want to say a little, I don't know if this was intentional, but I'm going to read this into it nevertheless. Did anyone else sort of think that the opening shots of that section with Nadine walking on the side of the road was almost as if Nadine Hurley had been given her own version of the street story? With the not just with the kind of the obvious visual connection of somebody on the side of a road in a country setting as cars pass by, but even the layering of the shots themselves and the crossfades had this kind of dreamy pastoral feel to it that I really loved. And I was, it's the nature of this show. I love that I'm watching this show and I have the sequence and I'm thinking to myself, okay, A, what in the hell is this leading to? B, how long could this possibly go on? Because most, you know, most, well, we should say pretty much all TV shows, a sequence such as that, you know, you're kind of, it feels particular, it would feel particularly out of place. But here, as the more or less the opening to this episode, I was thinking to myself, ah, here we are again. But yeah, it did make me perhaps want Wendy Roby to have her Richard Farnsworth moment. But
oh yeah, so with the use of like the crossfades and her sort of like skipping along the street and like the sunniness, it was cool how there was like this kind of 50s Hollywood quality, which is obviously something that Lynch always seems interested in sort of referring to and subverting. So I liked that. And I also just liked, as Nick was saying, the sort of the pastoral feel.
I mean, the cut to from that sky to another sky with the crackling electricity, but almost what I would describe as a boing-oing-oing-oing sound was pretty next level. I mean,
Alpha Coop saw an attractive lady walking down the street.
Yeah.
Sort of a girl can't help it kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like contractually obliged to mention that movie whenever we talk.
Well, I mean, too, I mean, if we want to get back to that whole Black Lodge sequence, I mean, what do we think of the, we could say another variation on the recasting scene in this show?
Yeah.
Perhaps two was, variations. But
that was interesting. No, I mean, I assume you're talking about the Philip Jeffries, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's certainly one, yeah.
And, okay, I don't understand why. I mean, I guess I don't understand why he's, like, a giant industrial teapot, but I also don't understand why, like, the voice, because I know, like, I know that Nick had mentioned at one point when we were talking about Twin Peaks that in the last episode where you saw like the old footage of Jeffries, it was like a different actor doing his voice. And I just have no idea why. I mean, I guess for this season, it's that he's very sadly no longer with us, but I don't understand why you would have some weird, like, growly, sort of ominous-sounding southern-ish voice doing David Bowie's character. That was very strange to me.
Well, Nick, you made the connection on Twitter, too.
Yes. So if I could set the scene briefly. So watching the sequence, did you say, oh God?
No, I said, go for it.
Oh, well, I readily believe you were just about to say, oh God. But so watching the sequence at Keith Ulick's apartment, dear friend to all of us, of course, is with a group of people. And I'm really wrapped up in the scene. I'm really into it. And I mean, honestly, watching it, I was kind of hypnotized by it. I found myself staring at the screen and receiving the images, but not actually realizing how much time had passed by in that moment. Mm-hmm. I just felt kind of lifted off the ground a little bit during that whole sequence. I thought it was really magnificent. The deep blacks and the superimposition of the forest and the sense of movements, mm-hmm. all great. And then you get to Philip Jeffries. I'm thinking, oh my God, is this going to be him?
Yeah.
And I start cackling in a way that the show has only made me cackle as hard maybe once prior, which was the sequence in episode 10, maybe, where Bobby sort of is being screamed at by the woman who's trying to get to her uncle's house or something. And she just kind of sounds like Sam Kinison, as I said, when she's screaming. So I start cackling so much because the voice comes on, and immediately at the drop of a hat, I am reminded of this thing. So, Ethan, I know that Late Night with Conan O'Brien was also a big part of your childhood cultural diet, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've talked about this at length in person, actually. Abby, I don't know if we've ever talked about this. Did you watch Late Night with Conan O'Brien?
I did occasionally. I feel like I probably don't have quite as many references from it as you do, because I'm not sure what you're getting at here.
Yeah.
Are you going to say that it made you think of, like, the masturbating bear or something?
Well, it did make me think of a mainstay skit, which is sometimes they would have televisions that come down behind Conan, and it would be the head of a person who was in the news, and it would be a pair of lips moving that they would superimpose from, like, behind the scenes or something, and it would, you know, just do an accent impression, say ridiculous things. And in 2004, they did an impersonation of the Georgia Democratic Senator Zell Miller, who infamously challenged Chris Matthews to a duel at the 2004 Republican National Convention. And I've watched it many times because I just think it's the funniest thing. The voice is kind of thing where he comes out and he goes, how dare you, sir? And he says, I challenge you to a duel. And Conan says, I'm not going to shoot guns with you. He says, swords it is. I will slice you with my Confederate saber. And I just immediately thought of this when Philip Jeffries starts talking.
I'm sure that's what David Lynch was planning to reference.
Well, because the thing is, he goes...
You never know.
He goes like, he says, Agent Cooper.
Yeah.
And he says, I told you I wasn't going to talk about Judah. Like, it's the same voice. Actually, today I found a clip of that scene on YouTube and I played it at the same time as the Conan O'Brien appearance. And it's really shockingly similar. I wonder if it's supposed to be comedic. I mean, because it does have this kind of arc, sort of cartoonish Southern quality to it. He kind of sounds like a stereotypical Southern gentleman in a way that...
Yeah. Sorry? No, I didn't mean to cut you off, but just the idea that he's, like, now, like, a giant industrial teapot. It's, like, some weird, like, dark fairy tale thing, almost. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so... Like, I know it's very easy to just say, like, something's weird because, like, duh, it's Twin Peaks, but it's definitely weird. I mean, it wasn't, like, any sort of human apparition, just that he's, like, this object now.
It's very steampunk.
It is very steampunk, yeah.
But, what did we think of that? Because I have to say, I definitely am not, I find it so weird and I'm not totally comfortable with them looping his dialogue from Firewalk with Me. And if you look and listen closely, it's pretty clearly looped because there's kind of an awkward moment where there's further dialogue that Bowie spoke, but that itself is not looped over and it just kind of drops out. And I guess I wonder if it's sort of a consistency thing he's going for, or the fact that it's, what's weird is that the sequence comes up, but it's not something that Alpha Coop himself would remember, because it's not him, right? It's the actual Cooper. So the fact that it comes up with that black and white filter and kind of the dreamy edges at the corners would give the impression that it's coming from this other place. But otherwise, I did really love that sequence. I also thought it was, I thought the whole sequence was fairly funny, if not also unsettling, in part because there's a whole shot of him with a notepad out writing down the numbers, which I found very funny, just this very practical thing he has to put into practice to get what he wants. Yeah. I love the scene overall, but I'm wondering what other people made of it.
Do we think that any of the numbers, because this isn't the first time that we've seen like random seeming numbers, do we think that they're going to come back in any way? Because I feel like there was that thing, which was already a while ago now, if that sort of strung out, like drug-addled single mother shouting out random numbers, and there was the shot that I think was also in Fire Walk With Me of like a telephone pole with numbers on it. And it's like, whenever I see that stuff, I'm like, numbers. But then it's like, I never know if I should be writing them down.
Well, I imagine realistically they're the coordinates to Twin Peaks, right?
Oh, mm-hmm.
That was my impression, because there are degree symbols contained therein.
Okay.
I want to bring this up, is that a friend of the show, John Samley, actually just dug up, God bless him, an article with David Lynch and ZZ Top's Billy Gibbons having discussion about Machinery. This is
an old article?
Yeah, this is from November 2011. So yeah. I just, maybe to segue into that sequence, because I thought the sharp-dressed man needle drop was interesting, in particular because Zuzu, the indie band who recently just did a whole album covering the music of Twin Peaks, and I've used them occasionally on this show, actually just recently covered Sharp-Dressed Man on AV Club's Undercover series. And it's a pretty dope cover, actually. But I thought it was, I don't know, like an almost odd coincidence about ZZ Top, because when we see the needle drop in that sequence, it's basically hipsters kind of dancing to it. And it seems like it's acknowledging, I don't know, the kind of kitschy 80s dad rock thing. That was interesting.
That is a great song, though.
Yeah, and it's interesting. In this article, again, it's Lynch and Gibbons just talking about Machinery and factories and the sounds they love and how they make... It's actually a pretty long article.
Also,
maybe
I just came up with a really good theory, which I'm sure is like 100% true, but maybe ZZ Top, maybe they are the woodsmen.
Whoa.
Ooh, shit.
Yeah, I'm onto something here.
Okay. Yep. Is Got a Light a ZZ Top lyric at any point?
I don't know, but I feel like it could be. I'm mostly just thinking in terms of like the beards and like the sort of rural type thing.
Sure, yeah. Just thinking. Huh. Yeah. All right, I'm gonna start jotting down notes while you guys talk.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my new thing.
Well, I mean, if we want to stay on that sequence, though, we do finally see the green-gloved kid in action.
That kid just seemed so random. Like, his story in the last episode, I was just like, is this, like, Lynch appealing to tweens who like Harry Potter? Like, I was kind of a little puzzled by that, but it was good to see him in action.
Well, I think, I mean, we were kind of theorizing on the last show that his action, his green glove of power would be him used to fight Evil Coop, but I kind of like the idea that it was just, he was sent there to punch James's romantic rival just so they'd be thrown in jail, then put in the jail cell opposite a lodge spirit, which will, I assume, lead into the finale.
Yeah, I heard a theory, a not unsound theory, that perhaps James will become the new sort of like one-armed man, basically, and the British kid will become the arm.
Well,
also,
which is a theory I like.
Also, I have to say, in like the jail cell scene, I mean, I feel like everyone hates Chad because, like, I mean, you know, he's gonna be an asshole because his name is Chad, and like he's so disrespectful to everyone and the sheriff's office and double crossing and all that. But I sort of started in this last episode kind of feeling bad for Chad, because I'm just like, you are stuck in this little prison cell with like the creepiest people possible. Just like him being in between the like drunk slobbery guy and the woman with no eyes who is like just periodically making like scary high-pitched noises. I don't know. It's got to be tough to be like a regular human in that jail cell.
I still feel like he deserves it.
I still think he's a jerk for sure, but
I feel like the treatment of him, if we do see him again, will be, I think of in the final episode when there's the one kind of smash cut to Leo, still holding the thing in his mouth so the tarantulas won't fall on him. I feel like if we see one more appearance of him, it'll just be a smash cut to him yelling, "Shut up!" in the jail cell.
Yeah.
His current predicament kind of feels like something that would have happened to a character in the original series finale. Like, that would have been the last we ever saw of him.
Basically, every episode of the new series is like an extended version of the finale of the original series, which is because it's just getting so much. He's just getting so much weirdness and so much. God, I was gonna say so much mystery, but I feel like that sounds a little like hippy dippy. But he's getting so much. He's getting so much mystery into every episode, and it's crazy.
We kind of got left on a cliffhanger, so to speak, this week. I mean, is Cooper back?
I sure hope that he is, because as much as I've been, you know, obviously everyone's been enjoying Dougie, but I'm ready for Cooper. And I also, like, there's a part of me that really just wants, like, Dougie to be, like, explained in a very linear way, but I know that's not going to happen, and I know I shouldn't want that to happen.
Who the hell knows? I mean, it is a thing where this, I guess, is a logical point to bring him back in the last 3 hours or so, especially as the narrative threads surrounding him are really starting to converge. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm also... Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange that basically all he had to do was put a fork in an outlet. And also, I mean, I guess I just wonder if that's the case, because, you know, sort of the music starts up that has him going towards the music when kind of the Deus Ex Machina is introduced, of having him do something, of having a Black Lodge force say, okay, now you have to go here, starts up, which indicates it's very much part of that. Just the fact that he pushes play on the television remote when there's kind of no particular reason why he would, except maybe I guess it does sort of relate to, for instance, when he stops the attack from Mike the Spike and he starts touching the policeman's badge, and Janie kind of slaps away his hand and goes, "No, don't touch that, Dougie." It does kind of bring that to mind, but yeah, I mean, Will Gordon Cole, will that name be the thing that brings him back? I mean, that would be, yeah, it would be a nice touch if the Lynch name technically is what brings him back. I do like that little potential grace note, let's say. But yeah, I was just going to say, this is probably the first work of art I've ever seen that uses what is essentially Turner Classic Movies as a Deus Ex Machina. And it's funny, too, because I can't think of a moment in Lynch's filmography that maybe so clearly has a moment indebted to cinephilia. I mean, I know that there is, of course, the whole Rita Hayworth, Gilda, Laura Ellen Herring thing in Mulholland Drive, but this is an actual scene where...
Wizard of Oz and Wild at Heart.
Wizard of Oz and Wild at Heart, sure, but this is a sequence, and this was brought up last night, but what I said was this is a sequence where the camera is actually planted in front of a television set as something is transpiring. And it is kind of this thing we talked about, I think it was last week, how the real world is finding, our real world is finding a way to intrude upon the Twin Peaks worlds in these very curious ways.
It's interesting. Because it's like, the show feels so much like its own entity that it's like surprising to even see that an actual... and not even just an actual movie, but like a classic beloved actual movie exists in that world. Like, it feels kind of jarring.
No, it's definitely jarring. I mean, you have to wonder, you know, did, like, has Bob seen a Billy Wilder movie before? You know?
Well, we know he likes golfing. So clearly he has interests outside of just, you know, all his other stuff.
Sure, sure, sure. But yeah, I mean, it's also well known that Sunset Boulevard is one of Lynch's favorite movies. So I did like him sort of sneaking that in. And of course, I think the moment just on Kyle MacLachlan's part of reacting to it is so wonderful. It just kind of plays as this great burst of energy that's been waiting to come about, kind of the top coming off finally. I don't know. I mean, I kind of bolted up a little bit too at that moment with him.
And he's really just been giving such a great performance that he just feels like two entirely different actors playing Dougie and playing Bad Cooper. I mean, he like even when he's Bad Cooper, like even like his skin, like he just like emanates this like grossness. Mm-hmm. And like as Dougie, he like obviously has that sort of purity and like sort of that childlike innocence, if you will. And it's just really compelling to see how he like embodies these two characters that are so different.
Yeah, I haven't heard enough appreciation for how, as this alpha coupe, he does a thing kind of with his eyes and his, almost like his chin, sort of, how he kind of lets it hang in a way, where I find that if I'm impersonating the character, I kind of do this thing where I have to put on this kind of hangdog face, kind of. And just the way he walks, it still feels like it feels like something has taken over a human body. Like a parasite has taken over a human body and isn't quite sure how to move, I guess I would say. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if we want to talk about another sequence, we have the kind of official passing away of Margaret Lanterman.
God, that was one of the best scenes so far, I think. Because it was so like emotional and like in an authentic way. And I also, in a way, I feel a bit relieved because knowing that the actress is actually in that condition, that she was actually at death's door, it's so painful and so, like, so vulnerable. And I know people often will say, like, sort of act like Lynch can be, like, sort of cruel in some ways just because his stuff is so, you know, so strange and so aggressively, you know, not going into any cliches, but like this scene was like really had an emotional power, I thought.
I mean, you're totally right that I think you are supposed to read her condition into the show or the scene. And I think there's sort of been this tension. I mean, because when she showed up in the first 2 hours, it kind of felt like, okay, that's in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, that's realistically probably all they could really get out of her. And then she's appeared in three more episodes, and it's like there's this odd tension to watching it every week in a way that I don't think is exploitive at all.
Yeah, no, but it's like still like it feels practically like watching somebody you know die. And that's really an intense experience that you don't get from TV ever. Also, I have to say, I want Hawk to be the last person that I talk to. He is so good. And I just, I love just like the gravity with which he speaks. Like I was in last week's episode, there was a scene where he just like had picked up sandwiches for the other people at the sheriff's department. And at one point he takes a sandwich out and he just goes, he's just like roast beef and cheese. And it just sounded so dignified, even the way he was announcing that he had a sandwich. So, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Hawk is just like, he's the man.
He's an actor who's aged into his kind of screen presence very well, I guess you could say. Like, something about his Michael Horst as an older man feels very kind of dignified, and there's something kind of very solid about his presence in it, as opposed to someone like Chad, who was kind of this blob sort of moving through the sheriff's office, which I think is actually illustrated really beautifully in the scene when he discovers the pages from Laura's diary. Mm-hmm. He's just kind of saying, use the ladies' room, Chad. I will say also about the whole log lady Catherine Coulson thing is that I think Ethan, I saw you tweet this, perhaps you had in mind, it brought to mind the log lady intros, which Lynch filmed Twin Peaks went on Bravo in the mid-90s. It was, for a long time, the last Twin Peaks-related thing he directed. And if you have the Gold Box DVD set, or if you have the entire Mystery Blu-ray set, you can actually watch them before each episode. It's what I do whenever I watch the series, because it feels like an essential part of the show. And that kind of direct address thing I thought was really fascinating, how she's kind of talking at once to nobody in particular and everybody after Hawk hangs up. And it's even the way the camera changes its angle, too, where it becomes something more of a direct address, the way it's facing her, I thought was really fantastic.
And I also think that there's definitely a parallel with Lynch's meditation, just this idea of, like, the acceptance of death and just, like, sort of not viewing that as an explicitly negative or scary thing. That seems like something that could have been gleaned from Lynch's own practice, which I thought was kind of cool and sort of added, again, more emotional heft to it.
No, absolutely. And I guess also just the whole, I thought there was sort of a weird kind of mirroring with the Ed and Norma sequence from the beginning of the episode, kind of as one thing begins to flower finally, one thing finally withers away and closes down. And it's interesting how both of the sequences are about elderly people and how in life you can have these very kind of perhaps divergent experiences at the same age, but also there are these weird parallels too, because it's the whole thing about how, you know, death is not the end, it's just a change. And that whole Ed Norma thing is, of course, about a change. It's certainly not the end. And how it's another moment where the show kind of seems to be breaking free from this, from kind of the strictures surrounding it in those shots, which we've had varieties of before, certainly. But in this particular moment, there is kind of this sense that time has stopped, which I also got from how it goes from her more or less direct address to the camera to the sequence inside the sheriff's department where Hawk tells the various members of the group. Because when that scene started up, and it's also a great little gag how Forster's Frank Truman has just a fish on his computer, which I thought was very funny. Not just a computer, but a MacBook Pro, so like kind of a high-end computer. He just has this drawing of the fish. I thought that was going to be the start to another sequence initially, and how it's willing to let that continue and let it be kind of its own thing in the grand tapestry of the show. Kind of the respect it pays Catherine Coulson, who it is known, you know, helped Lynch start his career because she's such a huge help on the set of Eraserhead and someone to whom he considers himself greatly indebted. That, and then also the fact that the episode is in memory of Margaret Lanterman, the character herself, which I found so fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, I also got to say, just with you talking about the parallels between that scene and the opening scene, it's like as soon as the Norma and Ed scene happened, and it was so happy and so sweet, I was just like, oh, shit, something really bad is going to be happening.
Yeah, I more or less thought the same thing.
Yeah, it's like, it would be kind of funny if it just was like the super happy episode.
To bring up a filmmaker who I know that I've talked with, I think in person at various times with the both of you about, and his relationship or lack thereof with Lynch, is that I don't know if either of you have seen Jacques Rivette's final film, Around a Small Mountain.
I have, yeah.
So in Rivette's films, there's this motif of sorts, let's say, of shots of the moon. That's something that Rivette has. That's something that is running through a lot of his work. And the final shot of his final film is the shot of the moon in sort of a dusk time of day, let's say, a dusk-like environment, and the clouds are sort of passing over it. And if you, like me, are an auteurist geek who made Around a Small Mountain the last Rivette film they saw for the first time, you felt, you know, you feel that strong nudge at that moment that this is really the end. This is the last breath of air before we close out. And there was something that I thought of there, the kind of that overlap. between Around a Small Mountain and this episode of Twin Peaks. I know that when people talk about Lynch and Rivette, it's always Mulholland Drive, Celine and Julie go boating, rightfully so. If you know me in person, you know that I have the Film Society of Lincoln Center's Lynch Rivette tote bag, which I carry around. So the overlaps have been stated before, but that was one of those little rhymes, perhaps unintentional, probably unintentional, that I really loved. I thought was just kind of divine. Thought that deserved a mention, but anyway. Yeah.
Also, I was thinking, actually, if Lynch had shown on the TV with Dougie, if it had shown, a Rivette movie or, some avant-garde film instead of Sunset Boulevard, I feel like all of film Twitter would have spontaneously, there would have just been, some spontaneous Twitter orgasm.
I would have liked if it was kind of like the Cape Fear scene where, the notorious Max Cady, having a ball at the movie scene, where it's not Scorsese throwing in him watching a Chaplin or Leo McCarey movie, but he's watching Problem Child.
Yeah.
What if, I know Dougie turned the TV on and Get Smart was on or something. I don't know.
It's not just any Rivette movie. It's a scene from the very rarely seen 4-hour cut of Vos au Bois, specifically.
Yeah. Everybody's going to need to point that out on Twitter.
Yeah. That would have been too much. I'm actually glad that didn't happen. The response to that would just be, you would open Twitter and it your phone would actually crack in half at that moment.
Yeah.
One last note I wanted to make is that I think this episode, having the credits take place, or at least the first end credit take place over Fade to Black, I think is only the original series did that quite often for kind of big cliffhangers. So it was interesting to see that come back. And it was nice to see The Vales, who notoriously their last album, Total Depravity, which is quite good. Everyone should listen to it. They recorded that album in David Lynch's house in L.A. So,
oh, wow.
It was nice.
Okay. Yeah. I was a little sad that we didn't get I thought it'd be nice to get Stern Kyle MacLachlan over Charlene Yee screaming, but perhaps as a signal that we are really moving towards the end, that is a...
And what did you guys think of the Roadhouse scene in this week's?
I loved it. I mean, I thought the song was great, too. I don't know if I've ever heard of The Vales, but I'll definitely have to give this album a listen, especially if it was recorded in Lynch's house. That's intriguing. It had kind of a similar sound to the song played by the band Trouble. Mm-hmm. In one scene, I think that's actually the episode, the scene where we first meet Richard Horne, and it also kind of reminded me of The Pink Room, the song from Firewalk With Me, the infamous sequence, Welcome to Canada, and I like that scene quite a bit. I also thought it was interesting how much of an overlap, visually speaking, there is with Cooper sort of rediscovering himself, maybe, climbing towards the outlet. It has me wondering what exactly is going on there, and if he does in fact make Charlene Yee sort of a key figure of this whole project, I won't be surprised, because expect the unexpected, of course.
Do you think her and Wally Brando are an item, and that's who she was waiting for?
The thought absolutely crossed my mind, yes.
Yeah.
Breaking out the Paper Heart references.
Oh, yeah. Also, just that final scene, it definitely struck me as a sort of having elements of some kind of weird sexual power fantasy, just with the way these guys were picking her up and putting her on the floor. It was definitely I feel a lot of times Lynch gets he gets kind of weird and kinky, and I feel that was sort of an example of that. But maybe that's just me.
I think it might just be.
The thought did not cross my mind.
Huh.
Well, this is why we're glad to have you on this week, Abby.
Oh, yeah. I just, ugh, jeez. But,
I like how you were clearly forming a thought there, and then you just decided, I'm not going to finish that.
No, I was trying to think what I was going to say. What else? Because I just feel so much happens in each episode, and I'm trying to think, is there any, major thing? Oh, something I really liked, going back to the, to the log lady death scene was that image of Hawk fading into the woods. That was just an amazing image. And Lynch is he's just so good at creating these really arresting moments that just like stick with you. Like I always tell when I'm talking about Lynch with people, I always tell them how Eraserhead was the first movie of his I saw, and I saw it when I was in like maybe 8th or 9th grade. I found it absolutely terrifying. And I just feel like that's part of his power, is just like there'll just be like a single image that'll just like stick in your head. Like just the image of like, you know, the baby or the lady in the radiator. That just oh god. I'm still scared to rewatch that movie, to be honest. Of the three or two that are coming up, I feel like at least one of them has to be sort of back to that crazy experimental vein. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like I'm absolutely not qualified to make any predictions.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. My guess, not that I'm really qualified either, hence this really just being a guess, is that we won't maybe get something as completely out there and just outright avant-garde as episode 8. But I imagine it'll be something of a similar kind of feeling, just more narrative and more grounded in the real world. Because, of course, if we think about the original series finale and what a thing that was, the potential for what he could do here with greater resources and greater freedom, it's very exciting.
I still haven't gotten over the ending of the original show. It's so deeply upsetting. Oh my god.
Well, you'll maybe get some closure to it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I feel like anything has to be less horrible and disturbing than that ending. Mm-hmm. But it's David Lynch, so.
Yeah.
So who the hell knows?
I'm mostly just sad it's going to be over before you know it. But,
Well, listeners can look forward to Ethan and I's Dice podcast.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. You're going to say you watched that, huh?
I watched the season premiere, the season 2 premiere of Dice, which, believe it or not, another Showtime series in which the main character wakes up in Las Vegas with no real association with the real world. Because the episode is Andrew Dice Clay's It's a Wonderful Life, where he's at a party and he meets with his old rabbi back from Bay Ridge. Or Sheepshead Bay, I have to get that right because they said it 8 times in the episode. And the rabbi says the world would be a better place if Andrew Silverstein were never brought into it. And then he wakes up the next day and nobody knows who he is. So the Dice Man got his It's a Wonderful Life. So if you want to see that, watch the season 2 premiere of Dice.
Worth bringing up too, online or available online, is Andrew Dice Clay as the host of SNL introducing musical guest Julie Cruz.
Oh, really? Wow.
He's got to say, live from the Roadhouse in Twin Peaks, USA, Julie Cruz.
Holy crap.
Wait, is that this. Cool? That's an actual thing that
yes,
happened?
Yes, I'll send you a link.
I can actually see him like in Jim Belushi's role.
I could, yeah, because he'd be riding the Blue Jasmine comeback coattails and things. Abby, where can we find you on the internet?
Okay, well, I've written for Village Voice, Playboy, Brooklyn Magazine, Nylon, all sorts of places, and you can find me on Twitter at Abby, ABBEY, _Bender, BENDER, or my portfolio is abbybender.wordpress.com, and yeah, I'm always interested in hearing people's peaks ideas, because I always... As much as I'm loving the show, I always feel like I'm missing things.
Nick, what about you?
As always, thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, various real world stuff with Grasshopper Film.
Mm-hmm. You can find me on twitter.com/EthanVess, and I will promote to my podcast, These Boys Are Good Boys, because I wanted to mention we just recorded an episode on late period Oliver Stone. And why I think this is worth bringing up is that Lynch and Stone were born in the same year, and they're contemporaries of a certain kind of post-New Hollywood American cinema. And I think talking about Lynch at 70 years old at the height of his powers, and Stone at 70 years old at the nadir of his powers is kind of revealing, I think. So I'll plug that. But otherwise, thank you for tuning in, and we only have 2 episodes left.